Evening, all y'all. All righty. So we're going to continue our discussion on the hydroplate theory. And from last week, hopefully you remember some of the stuff we talked about. But one of the things we talked about last week was one of the important things about any kind of good scientific theory is that you're going to be able to make predictions based upon those theories. And in order to be able to do that, you have to really be able to line out a lot of the key assumptions that are involved in any particular theory. And it's interesting because when you look into a lot of the older Earth perspectives and even some of the, what I guess you can call theistic evolution, which is kind of, doesn't work. A lot of the key assumptions that are made in those are not generally brought to the forefront. So I'm really appreciative for Dr. Brown's perspective and that he's very careful to make sure and bring up, his key assumption. So that previous section that we had covered explained why they're always required to explain ancient unrepeatable events. The flood is not something that can be repeated. There is something that God put in the sky to remind us of that, the rainbow, which is a good reminder of the fact that he will not do that again. The only starting assumption that we have that underlies the hydroplate theory is the one that's on the screen there. We talked a little bit last week. And everything else derived in this particular thought process is based on this theory and following the laws of physics. So there's nowhere that I saw in the book, and I'm certainly not a PhD in any of this stuff, but there's nowhere that I saw where Dr. Brown was trying to really twist the facts to make it fit. He was allowing the facts to speak for themselves. So the key assumption that we have in the hydroplate theory is that about half the water now in the oceans was once in interconnected chambers about 10 miles below the Earth's surface. Excluding the extensive solid structures of these chambers, which we will call pillars, and I'll show you a slide here in just a moment, the subterranean water was like a thin spherical shell averaging about 3/4 of a mile in thickness. Above the subterranean water was a granite crust, and beneath that water layer was basaltic rock. So when we look at this particular slide here, there's a couple of things that you can see. In the case of the Mohorovicic discontinuity, as which we'll talk about here in just a minute, is that the basics are that here are the pillars, and then, of course, the trapped water underneath of it. You have granite on the top, the layer of water, and then the layer of basalt or basalt. In that water, in that subterranean water chamber was dissolved salts and carbon dioxide, and the pressure was increasing due to tidal pumping. Mr. Simpson had covered that, and we'll cover it again in some detail. And then you have this layer, this line that's called the Mohorovicic discontinuity, and we'll chat a little bit about that. So this cross section that you see here, the aspects that we wanted to make sure and point out and especially focus on tonight is that Mohorovicic layer. A couple of things that would happen in a pre-flood Earth, or a couple of things that would be very obvious in the pre-flood Earth, is that Europe, Asia, Africa, and the Americas, that they would have been joined across what is now the Atlantic Ocean. So we'll look at a map several times, and I'll show you an image of that here in just a moment. But you kind of think about in your mind how the continents kind of fit together as a jigsaw puzzle, and that's essentially where they got the idea of Pangaea. How many of you have heard of Pangaea? Okay, Pangaea in and of itself is not necessarily an incorrect idea, but the way that it has been applied requires quite a bit of removal of land masses and addition of land masses and increasing and decreasing the sizes of the continents in order to make them fit the way that they had, the way that Pangaea was initially put together. So this distinction between the basalt and the upper mantle, the Mohorovicic discontinuity there, it was discovered in 1909 by a seismologist. And I cannot pronounce his first name. I was going to ask Katya before, and I forgot. But his last name is Mohorovicic, and it was thankfully shortened to the Moho. It's a lot easier to pronounce. So it's pretty interesting how he discovered it. Basically, he was examining how seismic waves travel through the Earth. And what he had noticed is that as the seismic waves would travel down into the earth's crust, they would get to a point where they would travel down and they would stop, well, not stop at a point, but they would change direction and speed up. So they'd go down through the crust and they'd hit the Mohorovicic layer and they'd speed across and then they'd come back out another spot on the earth's crust. And then they also did a number of other tests to help show this, but it's a pretty interesting discovery. It's actually one that's still talked about today. There was actually read an article a couple of days ago that mentioned the Mohorovicic layer. So it was an important find for geologists. So as I mentioned, with less water on the Earth's surface, all of the continents would have been joined together, and they would have been, for the most part, in the positions shown on this slide, roughly speaking. Okay, not 100% far apart. You know, they're not as far apart as they would be today. But the area between them, there would have been land. Okay? So, on the pre-flood crust, there would have been seas, both some deep and some shallow, and mountains. However, they would have been generally smaller than those of today, but some perhaps about 5,000 feet high. And again, he comes up with these numbers based upon physics, not simply just pulling them out of the air. So one of the common questions that kind of comes up when you look at this, the slide right before it, actually two slides, my screen isn't matching what's up there, sorry. So one of the things that you kind of get a common question of is, well, that's granite, and let's say 5,000 foot mountains, how does it float on water? Well, it doesn't. And so when we talk about that, the crust didn't float on water. Water was trapped and sealed under the crust in that diagram that I had shown you. The water pressure, of course, would also have partially supported the crust, but primarily it would have been held up by the pillars. Now, the crust was like a thin slab of rock resting on and covering like a waterbed, if you think about it from that perspective. Okay? Wow. It's really difficult to do this when you don't match that. Let's go back one. Okay, there we go. If you think about like a waterbed, and I know some of you are probably too young to remember waterbeds, but they were all the rage when I was a kid. All my cool friends had waterbeds. But if you had a waterbed and say you put a couple of pieces of plywood on that waterbed, they would move independently, but they would essentially be held up by the pressure of the water and, of course, by the boundaries of the bladder. So you kind of think about it that way, in that the earth would have been sitting on that those pieces of plywood, resting on and covering the whole waterbed. Now, as long as that water mattress that's underneath, you know, that the waterbed is really made up of, stays in one piece and it doesn't rupture, then a dense slab will rest on top of less dense water. Okay? So, however, unlike a waterbed seal, which is really only a thin sheet of rubber, basically a big balloon, if you will, the chamber's seal was compressed rock approximately or at least 10 miles thick. Pressures in the crust 5 miles or more below the Earth's surface are so great that the rock can deform like a highly compressed, extremely stiff putty. How many of you ever played with silly putty? You know, you put it on the funny papers and you could look at it. I remember doing that as a kid. It was a lot of fun. Now, you ever get, I lived in northern Montana. I grew up in northern Montana and eastern Montana where it got cold, really cold. And sometimes I would leave my silly putty in the car in the winter. And when I'd find it, you take it out of that little egg and you could move it, but boy, did it take a serious amount of pressure and effort to mold it. Well, you kind of think of rock that way, as it goes to a certain depth under the right pressure circumstances, it turns into almost a putty. And so because of that, the slightest crack or opening could not open from below. Okay, because of that layer of rock that would have been, there it is. Because of that layer of rock that's been compressed, the bottom sections or the underneath sections of the granite crust layer would have been relatively soft. Relatively. Okay? So it wouldn't have been able to split, in other words. At least not from below. So as the temperatures increase with depth, as you go deeper in the Earth's surface, the subterranean water at about a depth of about 10 miles would have been extremely hot. So that's where it brings up the second question. So if we're thinking about this in terms of a global flood and we have all of this water that's trapped underneath the granite crust, and because of the heat and pressure that it's under, it's very, very, very hot. Why, when the water escaped, didn't it just scald everything? Or maybe it did. It's a good question, right? So why wouldn't it then, if it had been hot, and we'll talk about some of those temperatures here in just a minute, wouldn't it have scalded all life on Earth? If the water just kind of poured out, it would have just killed everything, right? So it's a good question. And the answer to that is ultimately, no, it wouldn't have. Today's geothermal heat is largely the result of the flood, the leftovers of it. To understand why and to see why life was not immediately scalded on the Earth, one must first understand what's called tidal pumping in supercritical water. Kevin had done a pretty good job of covering these. I'll cover them again just to make sure that we're on the same page. We'll talk a little bit more about why the continents and the pre-flood mountains sank as the subterranean water escaped, and we'll talk a little bit more about that when we get to the four phases of the hydroplate theory. But let's talk a little bit about tidal pumping. Now, Kevin had talked, as I mentioned, he had talked about tidal pumping. And tidal pumping, you can think of it, how many? I know most of you have probably seen the tides come in and go out, right? So what controls the tides? The moon, right? The gravity of the moon, primarily, right? So if you think about it now, you have the Earth, and as the moon goes around the Earth, the gravity from the moon pulls the water with it. So it follows the path of the moon. So it almost forms like a bulge on the ocean as it goes around the Earth, and that's what causes the tides to go in and out, okay? That's primarily the main cause. Now, that would have continued to happen when the water was under the crust. Now, it wouldn't have been as noticeable, of course, but on the other side of that, the ground would have moved a little. I don't know how perceptible that would have been, but it'd be kind of creepy if it was. But as the moon would go around the Earth, of course, that water would be affected by the gravity, and it would stretch the crust, and then it would relax as the moon would go around the other side. Okay? So each tidal lift, as it lifted the crust, it transferred energy from the spins of the Earth and the moon on the Earth's to the Earth's crust. So at low tides, the crust settled down and it compressed and heated the pillars. So the temperatures in the subterranean chamber, they steadily rose. And would have generated much of today's geothermal heat. Some gases and minerals would have dissolved in this hot, high-pressure liquid water as well, especially carbon dioxide, salt, and quartz. It's interesting. I'm sure you've seen photos, or if not, they're interesting to look at. They found in several parts of the Earth, but primarily in the Russian area, some in Asia, but they found massive caves that are full of crystals. And we're not talking like little bitty crystals, you know, your esoteric friends would hang around their neck. We're talking crystals that are the size of this building. Monstrous crystals. And the caverns themselves, they run about 120 degrees. So when spelunkers go down there, they can't be down there very long because the heat will kill them. So this is an example of where some of those solids would have been dissolved. And what would have happened in some of the pre-flood Earth conditions, these crystals would have formed under that high heat. This process helps to explain how dissolved quartz petrified some wood and cemented flood sediments into sedimentary rocks. And it is described in the book. One of the interesting areas in the world, it's called the Petrified Forest. It's in, basically, it's south of us. It's in a large area that's been affected by the flood. And it's a whole bunch of leftover trees, but they're rock. They're solid rock. There's no trees that are standing. Well, there might be a couple, but they're very small and shrubbery-ish. But you have large trees that have been petrified, and they're all over the landscape, and they're huge. Well, how is it that these large forests were essentially all fossilized all at once, all petrified all at once? Well, it was because they were saturated with exceptionally hot water that was full of minerals that leached into the wood itself and then petrified them. I won't talk too much more about them, but the book covers it in great amount of detail. So, hey, finally it moved. Great. So the tides, as I mentioned, they occur twice daily. The subterranean water was also subject to that. And then at low tides, of course, they would have cooled back or would have settled again, generating a massive amount of heat, and the gases and minerals would have been dissolved into it. Now, when we talk about supercritical water, water isn't supercritical elements or supercritical fluids are actually pretty interesting. And Kevin, I talked quite a bit about them, but under normal conditions, at approximately one atmosphere, one bar, which is about 15-ish PSI, water boils at 212 degrees, right? You know, we all know if you go up in elevation, that boiling point changes. If you go down in elevation, that boiling point changes, right? It's because of the difference in pressure. Now, at regular pressure, or as pressure increases, the boiling temperature rises. So in order for water to be supercritical, water has to reach 705 degrees and 3,200 PSI. It's hard to really illustrate 3,200 PSI. I mean, it means pounds per square inch, right? But it's really hard to illustrate in a way that captures just how much pressure that is. Give you a quick example. I work at a refinery, and there's things called blast zones. There's a particular vessel that it runs at about 24 to 30 PSI, just 24 to 30 PSI. It's a fairly large vessel. And if that particular vessel were to overpressure, and at certain levels of overpressure, they have this this map that tells you if it blows at this particular pressure, this is how much damage it'll do. And if it's a higher pressure, this is how much damage it'll do. And if it's this pressure, then we're all in trouble. But this particular vessel is not, I mean, it's fairly large. I mean, it's bigger than, you know, it's probably about the size of a semi-tanker, like a tanker truck. But 24 to 32 PSI, if it were to, in the second area of the blast zone, it would take out most of the refinery. And it, not an explosion, not from a fire, but from the pressure that would be released. So as you have larger quantities of air, or in this case of water, and you pressurize it, the more you pressurize larger quantities, the more explosive it gets. Okay? So 3,200 PSI is a lot of pressure, and obviously 705 degrees is pretty hot as well. So at that particular point, water can no longer boil. So that's its supercritical point. After this, as it continues to heat, and whether it gets hotter or more pressure, it gets supercritical and it can no longer boil. If you get a chance, when you get home, or don't do it now, but just go to YouTube and Google supercritical water. It's really interesting. I'm not going to get into all the details right now. But after centuries of tidal pumping, the subterranean water trapped underneath the crust would have exceeded that critical 705 degrees, and the initial pressure of the 10-mile deep subterranean chamber was about 4,270 bars, or 62,000 PSI, which is well above that critical pressure. So it had the pressure, certainly, and then eventually the heat met that requirement as well. And so as the temperature increased, the pressure would have grown as well. The crust would have stretched, and the energy from tidal pumping increasingly ionized the water. So more and more dissolved solids, more and more gases would have been dissolved into that. And then it would have reached a point where it was basically at maximum resistance. And we'll talk about that here in just a minute. So the interesting thing about the way that water cools is that, or a liquid, we're talking about water, of course, but the interesting thing about the way a liquid cools is that it cools directly in relationship to its surface area to volume ratio. So think of it this way. If you take a spray bottle, and you take one of those little squirter spray bottles, right? And it can be room temperature water, but if you spray it in somebody's face, you know, in a nice way to try to cool them off, what does it do? Well, because you've separated those water molecules, it cools off faster. It's kind of the whole idea behind the why we sweat, right? So if you take room temperature water and you mist it into somebody's face, it feels cooler because it cools faster because it has been separated. The molecules are now smaller. The groupings of the water are smaller. So the higher the amount of surface area to volume, the faster something is going to cool. So the liquid in supercritical water has an area to volume ratio that is a trillion times greater than that of water that might have covered the Earth's surface. So if it has a trillion times greater surface area to volume ratio, then it would have cooled very, 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 very quickly. Okay, so we have these two components working together, surface area and pressure. Now, the liquid in supercritical water cools almost instantaneously if the pressure is released. Okay? So most hot liquids, they cool primarily by evaporation from their surfaces. And so because supercritical water consists of microscopic liquid-like clusters that are dispersed within water vapor, they cool very, very quickly. The smaller the particle, the longer it takes to cool off. So as this pressure was increasing in the subterranean water, and as it stretches the overlying crust, as a balloon stretches when you fill pressure in it, eventually the shell of the rock reached its failure point, and that failure would have began with a microscopic crack at the Earth's surface. Now, it's again a little tough to imagine at this particular point, but you imagine a balloon. And how many of you have ever seen or done papier-mâché? I mean, you think about the way papier-mâché works, right? I know the school kids have. But you take a balloon and you fill it up with air and then you wrap it in this gooey paper mixture, right? And it forms a little crust. Now what were to happen if you were to put more air in that balloon? If the balloon was strong enough, it would eventually break the outer shell. It's essentially what was happening here due to the pressure and heat increasing under the crust. So keeping all of this in mind, and I know that's a lot of information, but keeping all of this in mind, if a supercritical fluid sees a small decrease in pressure, it will produce a very large change in volume. So I use the example of that vessel at the refinery, that it's a fairly large volume and under fairly small pressure, but as you take large volumes and you increase pressure, it has a much larger effect when that pressure is released. So as supercritical water flowed toward the rupture, the pressure would have dropped, the vapor would have expanded, and it would have cooled almost instantaneously in most parts. Now this is the part where we get to a couple of interesting components to this. So eventually, the shell of rock that we are talking about would have reached a failure point. Failure would have begun with a microscopic crack at the Earth's surface. Now remember, I mentioned earlier that the lower levels of the granite would have been very soft, still hard, but very soft comparatively speaking. And so it wouldn't have started from the inside of the underneath. It started at the top. It started at the exterior of the crust. And then as that crack began to grow, the stresses that the crust was under would have been concentrated at each end of the crack. So, I'll give you another example. You take a paper towel and you hold it, you know, take a paper towel and you hold it on each side of your one side in each hand, and you just pull it apart. How hard is that to pull apart? Well, if it's a good paper towel, it takes a little bit of effort, right? Now, repeat the same process, but put a little slit in the center of it and pull it apart. How much harder or how much easier is it to pull it apart then? So once that crack started to form in the earth's crust, the pressure would have been pushing out of the ends of that crack, and it would have grown quite rapidly at a pace of about 3 miles per second. So when the crack started at the top of the crust, I'll be with you in just a sec, Mike. When the crack started, it would have started to split and traveled in each direction at 3 miles per second. It's pretty fast. Tremendous amount of pressure. Yes, Mike.
Has there been any correlation identified with where the crack originated from and where it went in relation to the underground caverns at all? Or
underground caverns, like the ones that I talked about?
Yeah. Or the pillars, maybe more specifically, because it wouldn't crack on the pillar.
No.
It's going to crack away from the pillars. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I mean, you could almost picture the underground caverns based on the trenches that it created.
Yes, you could. However, one of the phases in the four stages of the hydroplate theory is continental drift, and that would have pretty much wiped out anything that had been there before because most of it would have been crushed. But we will talk about that. It's a very good question. Okay, so as this crack continues, you have massive amounts of pressure, you have exceptional heat, and you have water. Now, again, we'll use the water balloon example. You take a water balloon, you fill it up with water as full as it can get, and then if you let go of the end of it, what happens to the water? It squirts out, right? Okay. Well, that's pretty much what would have happened once the Earth's crust would have cracked. That water would have been escaping very, very quickly, and it would have created a jetting fountain. What did the Bible say about that? That all the fountains of the great deep burst forth. That would do it. Okay? So remember, we still have a tremendous amount of water underneath the Earth's crust as this crack is forming around the globe. And within seconds of this crack penetrating down to the subterranean chambers, it would have followed the path of least resistance. That's what Mike was getting at. It wouldn't have gone through the pillars. It would have gone through the thinner sections of the crust, finding the least amount of resistance, and it would have traveled around the entire globe in opposite directions. It would have circled the Earth in about 2 hours. The initial stresses were largely relieved when one end of the crack either ran into a path left by the other end, like my windshield on my truck, or it would have also then traveled in a path that would have intersected itself in some way or another, because the Earth is a globe, forming a T or a Y. So somewhere on the opposite side of the Earth, these things would have been happening where the rupture had begun. So where the rupture began, as the crack went around the globe, it would have either connected with itself or interconnected with itself, forming a T or a Y. Okay? So as the crack raced around the Earth, the 10-mile thick crust opened like a rip in a tightly stretched cloth, that paper towel example that I used, and that the crust would have opened up. So this particular slide here illustrates the rupture and the jetting fountains. So as this thermal and electrical and surface energy that was in the water, it ended up not as heat on the Earth's surface, but as extreme kinetic energy in all the fountains of the great deep. Okay? So okay, so I'll keep going in here. I was going to add some other stuff, but we'll just keep going. So there are four essential phases of the hydroplate theory. The rupture, the flood, continental drift, and recovery. We're going to talk about each of these in some detail. But before I do, I want to mention a couple of other things here. So as the pressure in the subterranean chamber immediately beneath the rupture began to be released, the crust would have begun to fall, and the water would have been pushed out from underneath the crust, continuing this fountains of the great deep perspective or property. That supercritical water basically nearing atmospheric pressure, it would have exploded with great violence out of that deep slit in the crust that wrapped around the earth like the seam of a baseball. And so all along this globe encircling rupture, the path approximates today's Mid-Atlantic Ridge, the ocean ridge, the Mid-Oceanic Ridge, so on and so forth. And we'll get to some videos on that or some slides on that here in just a bit. But it would have continued to jet this water supersonically into and far above the atmosphere. Okay? The pressure that this water was under, as the crust split and it was releasing all that pressure, it would have been jetted way up into the atmosphere and out of the atmosphere. Okay? This is important when you look at some other features of the cosmological perspective that we'll get to later on. So much of the water, as it was squirting out, would have fragmented into an ocean of droplets that fell at rain significant distances away from the crack itself. So you can take the illustration, you take a garden, you give your 3-year-old a garden hose with a sprayer on it, and when they pull that thing up in the air and they pull the trigger, it doesn't just go straight up and come straight back down. Generally goes up and it spreads out a little bit. Now imagine that a massive amount of water going up and hitting the atmosphere, it would have spread out considerably. And it would have created a massive amounts of rain that really would never have been conceived of or seen before or after. So some of that jetting water would have risen above the atmosphere where it froze and then fell on various regions of the earth as huge masses of extremely cold and muddy hail. That hail would have buried, suffocated, and frozen many animals. There's an interesting section that he has in the book on frozen mammoths. Now, when you think of a woolly mammoth, just think of it for a second. He's got the long hair, right? And what kind of a climate do you generally picture it in? Yeah, they usually say it's cold. They usually have the woolly mammoth walking along the ice sheets, right? Except that's not how their bodies were designed. When what they have found is that they found, and the reason why they have this particular perspective is because of where they've always found the mammoths. They find them frozen in ice. So, of course, the natural conclusion is that that's what they lived in. Well, that's not the case. They find hair follicles or hair samples of a woolly mammoth, and their hair would not have been one to encapsulate heat. It would have been one to let it out. And when they find these frozen mammoths, guess what they find in their mouths? Not all the time, but quite often. Undigested food. Tropical plant material. In their mouths and in their stomachs. Which requires significant freezing for that to happen. And this would have happened all over the earth. Now, as this powerful jetting water and the rock debris escaped the Earth's gravity, it would have become some of the solar system's comets, asteroids, and meteoroids. Remember we watched that video and they found that that meteorite that had liquid water in it? Interesting. So when we look at the four phases of the flood, and I'm going to skip through a bunch of it simply because I know we don't have 16 weeks to cover all this. I do want to cover a couple of quick things here. We have four primary phases to the hydroplate theory. The rupture, the flood, continental drift, and recovery. So we've covered the rupture in some ways, or at least introduced the idea of the rupture. And that failure point that would have formed, remember I talked about this, how it would have grown at 3 miles per second. It would have encircled the globe, penetrated that subterranean chamber, and gone all the way around the earth, where it would have eventually met up with itself, and in the meantime, that subterranean fountains would have been released, and all that water would have escaped into the atmosphere and out of the atmosphere. So, as I mentioned, that subterranean rupture, when it formed, it would have formed this nice long crack all the way around the earth, goes up and over the top and comes back over here. So if you've ever looked at it from this perspective, the ocean ridges, they actually kind of look like a baseball. They kind of go around the seam of around the earth like the seam of a baseball. So as that subterranean pressure would have dropped to near atmospheric pressure, That supercritical water would have erupted violently out of that deep slit, and all along the ridge, a fountain of water would have jetted into and far above the atmosphere. And as that water is coming out, it's fragmenting, falling as rain, and covering the surface of the earth. So where did the water come from? It came from under the earth, but it also came from the sky, because it came from under the earth first. Okay? So, here's another quick illustration of what that might have looked like. That's one of the things that when we get to heaven, I don't know if we'll just know it, or if I get to ask, or if I get to see it play out, or whatever, or if I'll even care. But I really want to see this. So, keeping in mind all of this, this water and this rupture phase, this water as it's being released is not only is it being released and releasing the pressure, but it's basically carving out either side of the crack. So all of that rock and all of that earth's crust and the sedimentary layers and the trees and everything else would have been getting pulverized and pushed apart. That's why if you look at that initial illustration of where the continents may have been before the flood, they weren't touching. Well, that's because all that rock that used to basically be the bridge between them was pulverized. And then it was spread out over the surface of the earth. So in the flood aspect, or the flood stage, each side of the flood of the rupture was basically a 10-mile at least high cliff. So these compressive and vibrating loads in the bottom half of the cliff face, they greatly exceeded the rock's crumbling and crushing strength. So the bottom half of the cliff was continuously crumbled, continuously collapsed, and it spilled out into the jetting fountains. Now, if you remember from one of the earlier slides that I'd shown, you have granite, and then you have the water, and then you have basalt. What is one of the most common rocks you find on the earth today? It's basalt. It used to be under, but now it's above. And you notice how if you walk down the river and you see most of the kind of plain gray rocks you find, that's basalt. You notice that most of them are pretty smooth. You don't generally find big jagged chunks of basalt. You do if you dig. But most of the basalt you're going to find on the earth is very smooth, partially because of this erosion. So as this cliff continues to break up at its bottom, it spills into these jetting fountains. And then eventually, the top half of the cliff also crumbles and falls into the fountain. So you have this pulverization of the crust happening, and it's jetting it out across the surface of the earth during the flood. So it would have been a supersonic flow. This water would have been under such pressure. Remember, it was under at least 3,200 PSI. It's probably much higher than that. And at least 705 degrees for it to be supercritical. And so when it was released, it was supersonically moving and creating quite a bit of quite a mess. And so consequently, this 46,000-mile rupture would have rapidly widened to an average of about 800 miles all the way around the Earth. So if you look at the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, it's about 800 miles on either side on average. Okay? So, because all of that initial land, sorry, let me back up and restate that. It would have widened to approximately 800 miles before the crust underneath or the would have buckled up, and we'll get to that here in just a minute. So, couple more slides here, just to again illustrate this. So, you have that middle section there where the crust or the crack had initially formed. You have the water jetting out, and then these gaps here, at least in the early stages of the flood phase, would have been approximately 800 miles wide. Extreme rain would have been falling in all the other areas around the earth, and especially closer to the crack itself. Again, just a reminder of this, of the ocean floor. There's a distance between the continents and the Mid-Atlantic Ridge that you can do some math on. It's pretty interesting, but you can see that how that crack forming here would have pushed these continents apart, and the initial pulverization would have happened right around the outsides of that crust, or right outside the edge of the crack. Okay, so about 35% of the eroded sediment were from the basalt of the chamber floor. Sediments swept up in the escaping floodwaters would have given the water a very thick and muddy consistency. These sediments would have settled out over the earth, over the surface of the earth in a few days. It would have trapped and buried many plants and animals, beginning the process of forming the world's fossils. This rapid burial process is the the minerals that are dissolved in the water help us to understand why we have large collections of fossils in the strangest places. A great example of that is the Lewis and Clark Caverns. Any of you ever been to that? And as you walk up the hill, up the side, you just look in the side of the mountain, and there's millions of seashell fossils. The Pryor Mountains out south of Billings here, there's an area where it's kind of remote, tough to get to, but you go out there, you can stand and you can actually see Billings. It's kind of cool. But you look down and you're standing on seashells, fossilized seashells, billions of them. Well, what are they doing at that elevation? That's one of the questions that's difficult for the evolutionary perspective to answer, at least to answer adequately. So, during this particular process, there's a phenomenon called liquefaction. Liquefaction is basically the reason why, during a flood, why you have the really fine sedimentation layers at the top and the heavier stuff at the bottom. As it would have sorted out, the liquefaction would have caused a tremendous amount of sorting within the soil itself, explaining what we call the geologic column, and or what science calls the geologic column. I'm not going to get into all of that, but that's the reason why it had happened. Okay, so the rising flood water would have eventually blanketed the water jetting from the rupture itself. So the water would have gotten deep enough that the pressure of the water being released was not able to overcome the water that was on the earth. So without major mountains, the earth would have quickly flooded. Okay? So, here's an example for you. It's kind of interesting. You should Google this when you get a chance. Google a microscopic view of the surface of a cue ball. Okay? So, if the earth were smooth, like a billiard ball, there would be enough water on the earth today to flood the earth to a depth of 9,000 feet. A cue ball or a billiard ball, a pool ball, they are not that smooth, especially when you blow them up, when you look at them microscopically. Okay? All right. So today, the volume of all land above sea level is only 1/10 the volume of water on Earth. I know that's a little bit difficult to visualize, so here you go. This is a visualization, an illustration, of the volume of water and air contrasted with the volume of water on Earth today. There's a whole lot more Earth than there is water. That's illustration today. Okay, and of course this was used as a tool to push global warming, but that's a whole other thing. I'll use it this way. So it's pretty wild to think about the surface area of the earth compared to the surface or to the volume of water. I have all kinds of math that we can do, but obviously we don't want to get into that and I'll put you to sleep. But the whole point is that there's a tremendous amount of water on the earth. If it was smooth today, 9,000 feet deep of water. So just another quick example, Lake Superior. It contains enough water to cover North and South America to a depth of 11 inches, just in one lake. Lake Superior would cover an area of about the size of North Carolina, or from approximately Boston, Massachusetts, to Washington, D.C. So, there's a tremendous amount of water that's still on the earth today, but not nearly the amount that was on the earth previously during the flood. So because the thinner and higher portions of the crust were supported entirely by subterranean chambers, water, primarily the continents and pre-flood mountains, would have sank as the supercritical water would have escaped. So therefore, the flooded earth resulted as much from sinking continents as from rising water. This is an important point where I'm going to leave you with this tonight so that we can get into this next week. But as the water is being ejected out from underneath the earth's crust, the continents would have begun to sink. They would have reached a point of equilibrium eventually. And part of the reason for the flood and the way that it happened is because of that, not just because of the water coming down. Okay. I'll leave you with that slide. I know, again, I've covered a lot. Any questions? Okay. Mr. City.
Have we been able to duplicate the supercritical, I mean, like 3,200 PSI mm-hmm. over 700 degrees? Have we been able to duplicate that?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yep, yeah, and it's actually used in a lot of industrial applications. Okay. It's pretty cool. Google it or YouTube it or whatever. And somebody else had their hand up? Mr. Toole. I'll be right back with you, William.
I might have missed the full point you were making about the cue ball. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is what you said, but I had recently read that if you could take the Earth and shrink it down to the size of a cue ball would be more rough than the Earth.
I did not say that, but yes, you are correct.
So that, to help us understand how easy it would have been to flood the Earth, mm-hmm. under a microscope, like you're saying, a cue ball is actually more rougher on its surface than the Earth would be yes. if we could shrink it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that clarification. Oh, bro Brad.
On that one slide is saying something about electricity. Mm-hmm. How'd that play into this?
There's actually quite a bit to that, but a lot of it would have been formed from static, moving materials. Mm-hmm.
So Jeremy hit on my thought, but when subjected to higher pressures, the water reaches the supercritical point. Mm-hmm. Do we have an actual like formula for however much water temperature would have rose beyond after a certain amount of like bars added to it? So at like 220, yes. it's at 705. At what yeah. is it, 300 and something?
705,
right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. At the bar pressure level that it was at, how much water pressure or how much temperature would have that water have been under at that point, roughly?
There is there's a graph in the book that covers that. I don't recall what it was, though. So it's a good question, though. Okay. Bro Brad has one more comment.
So where'd all that water go that's missing?
You'll have to come back and find out. All right. All right. Thank you for your time.